Welcome, everybody. It's time once again for the next chapter with Charlie Hedges. As he explores turning the page on his life and yours.
Producer Paul, how many times has something totally unexpected happened to you that seemed to shape your immediate or even your long-term future?
More than I expected.
My guest today, Dr. Neil Farber, presents a powerful case for the miracle of serendipity and the art of paying attention. As Neil Farber and I chat, it becomes apparent that many of our most important decisions in life are the result of unexpected and surprising events that seem to occur out of nowhere. A man with fabulous stories about life's serendipitous events, Dr. Farber convinced me that my life personally has been more determined by serendipity than it has by conscious planning. Now that was a surprise. Neil Farber's book, Serendipity, Utilizing Everyday Unexpected Events to Improve Your Life and Career, offers a most helpful review of serendipity and important tools for identifying when such events happen in your life. With that, let's hear what Dr. Neil Farber has to say about serendipity and the art of paying attention. Dr. Neil Farber, welcome to the next chapter with Charlie.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
It's great to have you. You know, Neil, you have written a fascinating book, Serendipity, Utilizing Everyday Unexpected Events, to improve your life and your career. And as much as I love the subject of serendipity and I want to talk about it, I have a totally unrelated question. And what I want to know is this. What is it with physicians, retirement, and writing books? You are my second doctor in a month that's written a book. What is it with you guys? You got to have something to do, so you got to write a book?
Well, I guess so. I mean, I had absolutely no intention of writing a book. Never came to me. I was an academic physician for 40 years. Wrote over.
Well, will you explain what an academic physician is? I know, but
yeah. So basically it means you're employed by a university and you see patients and do teaching, but you also have the responsibility of doing some kind of research. That's basically an academic physician.
So you did a lot of writing then?
Yeah. I wrote over 60 articles. And basically it was in medical ethics. That's the area I was
interested in. Oh, really? Really?
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
And a lot of my peers and colleagues told me I should write a book that, you know, summarizes everything. And I kept saying that basically it's sort of self-serving, that I would be just repeating myself just in order to write a book. And I had absolutely no intention of doing that. And then a month before I was going to retire, I went to bed, woke up at 3:00 in the morning, and instantly knew what book I had to write. It just came to me. And I, as I began writing the outline, I realized why it came to me, and that is that much of my both professional and personal life was influenced by these serendipitous events, and I needed to sort of convey that message to other people.
That's great. I'm so glad you did. As soon as I saw the title, I wanted to have you on the show. Because I personally so believe in serendipity and the relationship between, you know, sort of unexpected, unpredicted events in everyday life. And I can't wait to further discuss this with you. But really, before we get into it, I think it's essential that we define terms. And so we're all talking the same thing with regard to serendipity. How do you define serendipity?
I guess the easiest way of defining serendipity is look, as a lot of people have said, well, what's the difference between luck and serendipity? Aren't they the same? And the answer is absolutely not. Luck is something that just happens to you without your involvement, whereas serendipity, you have to be involved. You have to take agency in it. And the perfect example is if you were, you know, let's say you were out of work, needing money, and a long-lost relative who you didn't know sent you a check for $5,000. Serendipity is you're walking down the street, same situation, you need the money. Walking down the street, you happen to see a penny on the ground. And most people would just pass it by, but you decide to pick it up because you're curious. And you look at it, and it's an older penny. It's from 1922. And a friend of yours had one time, you remember, had one time said, if ever you see a penny this old, don't spend it, don't ignore it, take it to a coin dealer because it could be worth a lot of money. So you remember that, and you heed that advice. You take it to the coin dealer, and he says it's worth $5,000, that's what I'll give you. Same outcome, but with serendipity, you have to be involved.
I like that. I have never heard that definition. I've read several definitions, and that's your involvement really does. Serendipity really does require your involvement in several realms, right? I mean, it's not only paying attention, but it's acting on it, it's recognizing it, and we're going to talk all about that in this show. And I'm very excited. But you know, one thing, you are such a good storyteller. I would love for you to give me an example. And I'm not going to say your favorite, because I know you have dozens of favorites. But can you give me, apart from the penny example, a real-life example of a serendipitous event that will give all of us a clue of what's really going on?
Sure, and I can give you one from history and one from mine. And the history one is basically Thomas Edison was experimenting with the telephone that had been invented just a year before. And he was trying to see if he could record the sound waves from the telephone onto a piece of paper, just to see if he could do that and you know, make a written record of it. And so he took the telephone, and it has a diaphragm in it, this rubber membrane over the mouth, over the earpiece. And he attached a needle to it, and it was going to etch into a piece of paper. And as he was adjusting it, there was some sound in the room, and it vibrated and stuck his finger. And he looked at that and realized, hey, wait a minute. If this sound could stick my finger, it could stick something pliable. And so he developed a wax cylinder, had it rotating, and spoke into the microphone part of the telephone, and lo and behold, it etched something in the wax, and when he put a needle in to try and play it back, it played out Mary Had a Little Lamb, which is what he had spoken into the telephone. And so this is how the phonograph was invented, because of the fact that he got his finger pricked and recognized that.
Yeah, but that's quite a brilliant step, isn't it, to go from the process. It shows his genius, the process that he was able to figure out that it might record something just from sound.
Well, was it his genius or was it his experience? He had done lots of stuff along those lines, so he's very experienced in that. And that's how he made that connection.
I like that distinction.
It wasn't necessarily genius. It was experience that did that.
And you said you had a personal experience that you wanted to relay.
Yeah. One of my examples was, I had my first academic position. I was interested mostly in how physicians and patients talk to each other. And that was my major interest. And as part of that, I worked with a group of people who were social psychologists and got trained, basically, in survey research. Survey research isn't that great for communication skills, though. And there's some things you can do with it, but not a lot. So I was sort of, you know, trying to figure out what I was going to do. And in the second position that I held, we moved because of various things. I wanted to be closer to Philadelphia, which is where my wife grew up.
Uh-huh.
They had a weekly meeting, and this one meeting that they had in my division of general internal medicine was all about medical ethics. And the particular topic was about how do you decide who gets medical care when there's not enough care to go around. Like, for example, if two people have a cardiac arrest in the hospital at the same time and there's only one resuscitation team, who do you decide who gets that team? Oh, and there was a lot of discussion going around about it. One of the residents raised his hand and said, this whole discussion is moot because we always decide based on who needs it the most. And immediately the thing that came to me, because I had been reading a lot about like bias in how you approach patients and things,
sure,
was the fact that residents always have different biases. And I said, hey, wait a minute. I know that what that resident's saying wasn't completely true. I wonder if there's a way I could get at that. And, you know, I thought about my experience with survey research and realized one of the things I had learned was about doing hypothetical scenarios, writing, like, short little snippets of a case that someone could say, yes, I would, or no, I wouldn't. And so I gave the residents a survey based on different biases that they might have and proved that there were significant biases in residents' decisions about when they made a decision about who was going to be resuscitated. And that got presented and published and led to my going on to write eventually about 40 different articles in medical ethics.
All on that subject or all around that subject?
All in different, all about medical ethics, but in different subjects in medical ethics. Because I got interested and realized that this was a whole avenue that I could pursue.
Yeah, and such difficult questions. You know, I mean, that is a, I mean, that question is, it's beyond most of us. You know, you're talking about somebody living or not living.
Yeah.
What a fascinating subject.
Pretty tell heavy.
Me, tell me, yeah, very, very heavy.
Yeah.
Tell me, now you woke up one night and decided you were clear on a topic that you wanted to write. Were there any serendipitous events in the process of writing and publishing this book?
That's a good question. You know, as a writer, you oftentimes search long and hard for a way to get things published, which I did. I happened to see a small ad for a independent company that did hybrid type of publishing, and in fact were the ones that invented the idea of hybrid publishing, and thought that might be a way to do this. Again, for me to be invested in it, and submitted my, what they required, I think it was basically a synopsis and a couple of chapters of the book, and they went, yep, we want it. And luckily I went with them, and it eventually got published.
That's great. What is, I'm not familiar with hybrid publishing. I mean, they take on all genre?
Yeah, basically the traditional way of publishing is either you have an agent or you go to a small independent publisher.
Right.
But they publish your book. They take care of all the in-between steps, which are different types of editors and graphic designers and stuff like that,
right,
which costs a lot of money. And then at the end, they take 90% of the profits and give you 10% of the profits as a royalty. A hybrid publisher, they take care of all the steps and pay the money for that, but you give them some of the money to do that. So you have a financial investment in it, and then you get a higher percentage of the royalties. Now, I was never interested in royalties. That didn't matter to me. I just felt I had a message that I wanted to get out, quite honestly. So it didn't matter to me if the book, you know, was a bestseller or not, which is usually the case in nonfiction books, but I just wanted as many people as I could to read the message. So for me, this was the perfect way to do it.
Why was this so important to you, Neil?
Well, when I realized that, this had been so much of my life and had been there were so many incidents in history where these things occurred. It dawned on me, and there were anecdotal events in which, as well, in which some people didn't recognize a serendipitous event when it happened. And it dawned on me that there are lots of people out there who might benefit from this. But perhaps maybe even more importantly, there might be that really big event out there that is waiting to be discovered that might really influence society in a positive way. And for people to, for us to have, all of us to have that happen, we need as many people to be able to do, to be able to have the skills and pursue serendipitous event when it occurs.
You know, I would...
The other thing that was...
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, go ahead. Well, the only other thing I was going to say is the other thing is with COVID, it has been such a difficult year and a half. I think people, and now we're beginning to come out of this, so I think people are really looking for ways, plural, to both psychologically and financially recover. And this is one small way that might be beneficial to them.
I like that. That's very helpful. You know, in the subtitle of your book, you write that you write that everyday unexpected events will improve your life and career. I totally concur. How do you see this as happening? How do these serendipitous events, how can they improve your life and career? And also, as an aside, I just thought, can they take you in a wrong, you know, an unhelpful direction?
Well, the answer to both is yes. You know, how do they improve your life and career is, well, if you find something in your life that is something you can take hold of and do something with, it could be, it is at least, for me anyway, it was always at least this wow type of feeling. I used to get a tingle up the back of my neck. I would sit there and go, oh my God, I know what I have to do next. You know, that kind of feeling. And for me, it developed my academic career, helped develop my academic career. It helped get me promoted to professor of medicine. And most importantly, it allowed me to find my wife of 45 years, without which I never would have found her.
Tell me about that. How did that happen?
it's a quite interesting story. I don't know that I can spend the time to go into it in detail, but I will say this. I was visiting my roommate at his parents' house. This was when I was in medical school in Connecticut. My wife was visiting friends of her family with her family in New York. We were both headed back to Philadelphia. It was a rainy day. There were all these missed connections and things that happened that ended up putting us on the same train, that if they never would have happened, I never would have met her because I wouldn't have been on that train. We met. I was infatuated because of her personality besides her looks. By the time we got to Philadelphia, I asked her out to this free concert that the Philadelphia Orchestra always played at in Fairmount Park in Philadelphia. And that was going to be on a Tuesday. This was Sunday night. We were going back. And she said, call me Monday and I'll let you know. Well, it rained really hard on Monday, and Monday night's concert was supposed to be Van Cliburn, who is a world-famous pianist who always played with the Philadelphia Orchestra every year. And because that was like the main concert of the summer, they postponed his concert to Tuesday night and canceled the Tuesday night concert for which I had tickets. And as I was about to call her and see if she wanted to do something else, which is obviously pretty lame, right? The phone rings. It's a friend of mine who called me and said, I had two tickets for Monday night's concert to Van Cliburn, but now it's been postponed to Tuesday, and I have a conflict. Do you want two tickets to Van Cliburn?
Amazing. Now, that is serendipity.
I said yes. I called my future wife. She said yes. We ended up dating for about 3 weeks, at which point I looked at her and said, you know we're going to get married? She said, yeah, I know. And it's 46 now in terms of how long.
Oh, my goodness.
Years later.
Oh, my goodness. What a great story. What a great story. And that is, you know, you getting that phone call is just out of the blue, unexpected. You know, you think it's going to be a dismal day, and it turns out to be a delightful day.
And I go into detail in the story, and you'll see it's these multiple events that any one of which, if it had been different, we never would have met.
You know, as I've been thinking about this and reading through your materials, you know, I have to say that I feel that it seems like my entire life is one long chain of serendipitous events. Although I feel that I am rather skilled at planning, when it comes to major events in my life, however, more of them came about from paying attention to life than from a rigorous life plan. And that I look back on my life, and there's no way I could have projected I'd be doing what I do today or most of what I've done in life. Do you think that's more common, or do you think that's uncommon?
What I think is that if you pay attention, there's at least some aspect of that in everybody's life. I think it varies how much. You know, I knew from a young age I would be a physician. I had no idea what that meant, and I fully expected it would be like in a small town taking care of patients. That was it. And country doc, basically, yeah. Because that's where I grew up. I grew up in the Catskills in New York, and I figured that's where I was going to be. I'd be a country doc, and that would be it. And because of some things that happened with me, it totally changed my interests and actually was more in keeping with who I am and what my interests are. But I didn't know that at the time.
So big picture, you had a big picture plan, but the details of the plan happened through a continuous onslaught of circumstances and unexpected events and serendipitous events.
That's right.
That sort of honed the direction.
That's right. And I think it varies in somebody's life how much of that is true, but I think there's always at least some room for it.
I noted that you wrote a bit about curiosity and that the curious person may be more likely to discover serendipity, and I find myself a very curious and very hungry for adventure sort of person. So, you know, predicting the future in my life is boring. I look forward to that crazy, unexpected, oh, I've never thought about that. That's a fine idea. Let me do that. Or in the process, you know, I think we might have talked about it over the phone, that when I quit, I was a minister, and I quit being a minister, and I just said, in 1 year, I'm not going to be in ministry, but I have no idea what I'm going to be doing. Well, three quarters of the way through, I received a phone call from Chevron that asked me if I wanted to be an external trainer, and that was sort of out of the blue. That was totally unexpected, and that shaped my career for in bits and pieces for the next two decades.
Right. That's a sort of typical thing that has happened to me too, and I think it's happened to a lot of people. You have to be open to it.
Yeah, is there part of the creative person that is more likely to be open to this than someone else?
Maybe, but I think you can develop that. You know, we teach our medical students about open-mindedness and how to look at everything around them in a way to improve their interactions with patients. So I think basically you can train somebody to do that.
Really? Oh, that's that's hopeful. That's hopeful. You know, you mentioned a word earlier, a phrase earlier that really struck me as I was thinking about it, and that's serendipity absolutely demands paying attention. That's not common in our society today because we live such rote lives. You know, we do the same thing in the morning, go to work the same time, come home the same time. You know, everything is calculated and repetitive. And so that reduces our inclination to truly pay attention to the moments. And it seems like it would be very easy to miss one of those surprisingly beneficial, unexpected events. Would you agree with that, that paying attention is very essential?
I do agree. And I do agree that because people oftentimes have a rote life, that they don't pay attention or have gotten so sort of, you know, develop their armor and just, you know, put their head down and go through the day, that they don't take it in. And they're missing so much. There's like so much incredible stuff all around us. Even if it's just a tiny little thing, it doesn't affect your whole life. It's just so much a gas and so wonderful to see those tiny little things that are around you.
Yeah, you know, it's I would add another concept to paying attention, and I don't know that you write about this, but it's very common in my life, and that is reflection, is that I have probably an hour a day where it's just purely in reflection of the day and of what I've been reading and what I've been thinking. And that gives me an opportunity to use paying attention and curiosity and see where are the connections, as we will talk later about connecting the dots.
Right.
There's something critical about contemplation or reflection.
Yeah, I agree. And I think reflection is part of self-awareness and part of what we teach medical students as well.
All right. You know what I want to do is I want to take a break right now, Neil, and I would like to come back, and I want to go. You offer a marvelous set of tools that we can apply to serendipity. But before we do that, we need to take a brief break. Okay.
Okay.
Hi there, this is Charlie Hedges, and you're listening to The Next Chapter with Charlie, and my special guest is Dr. Neil Faber, who has written a book on serendipity and how unexpected events will improve your life and your career. And we've kind of gone through a bit about serendipity, and Neil has created a list of, not a list, but a subset of tools that we can use that can improve our ability to find serendipity and use serendipity. You write that serendipitous events are common, but we can still miss them when they come upon us.
Yes.
What advice do you have for recognizing these events when they occur?
Well, I think there's several skills that one needs to be able to recognize them. And again, these are things that you can train somebody to do or train yourself to do. The first is for self-awareness. And part of that is the acceptance that these serendipitous events are occurring to all of us all the time on a regular basis, but also to be able to be aware of your surroundings all the time and to reflect on them, like we talked about. And that's the first step. The other thing that one needs is to hone your observational skills, both in terms of visual skills as well as listening skills, to be able to pick up those times when, hey, this is something that's, you know, out of the ordinary. And then curiosity is asking the question, how or why? That's one of the real basics of recognizing serendipity, is being able to say, hey, this is different than what I expected. How did this happen? So that you begin to explore it. And then making connections basically either from the past in terms of your own training, education, readings, or going forward, being curious and reading about these issues, is making connections with it and saying, I know what this is going, what is going on. I need to explore this.
You know, the very first one you mentioned about awareness, you know, you also wrote keeping an open mind, and you talked about an open mind. How do you train people? I mean, we are not trained to keep an open mind. I mean, look at our country today. I mean, you know, with the divisiveness that is going on in our country, there is not an open-mindedness. There is my way or the highway. How do you train people to get an open mind, to think out of their box?
Well, I think the first thing to do is training them to have mindfulness. That is, what's all around you, and there are different techniques to do that. For example, one thing we do with the students is to give them a raisin and say, put this in your mouth, don't chew it. Close your eyes and think about anything that comes to mind about what's in your mouth. The taste, the texture, how it feels on your tongue, temperature, whatever it is that comes to mind about the raisin that's in your mouth, you know, be aware of that. And that gives them sort of the sense of how you can, when you do open your eyes, is to look and see what's around you. And when you begin to explore that and accept that, you sort of get a more open-mindedness about looking at things from different points of view.
I like that. I like that exercise. Do you encourage people to read or ponder outside their preferences?
Yes. First of all, there are books about open-mindedness and self-awareness. But besides that, the more you explore outside your natural environment, the more you will be accepting of things around you.
We did a podcast, oh gosh, a couple of months ago, and it was on. It talked about, we are very informed. I think. Our country, our individuals are more informed now probably than in history, except they are informed by what they already believe. That I will listen to
preconceived notions.
Yes, I will listen to news sources that feed me information that support what I already think. And that way, it only sets up the opening for a closed mind, the opening for a closed mind,
mm-hmm.
the opportunity for a closed mind, because I'm only supporting what I believe. Now, I personally read, you know, I'm one political party. I read journals from the other political party just so I can understand how the thought process is. What is the rationale behind decisions? Whether I agree or disagree is not, that's not the point. I'm just trying to understand. I'm just trying to understand mm-hmm. where someone's coming from. And there are times that I have changed my mind as a result, that they offered a better argument than my argument. I think that has to do with, I can see the relationship with serendipity in that, and that if we keep a closed mind, that we live in a closed environment, We're not going to be open to that unexpected. We're not going to even catch that. That is why the next skill is so essential, and that's your observational skills. That's about paying attention and
and
observing.
Right. So there are two levels of observation.
Okay.
There's the observation of this whole big picture around me, but there's also the observation of the tiny little details around. And those can sometimes be important too. One of the things I showed in the book is one of the things I did and decided to do upon retirement is try and, before COVID hit, go to as many of the national parks as I could. And in November of 19, I was in Arches National Park, and I was at one of the arches called South Window. It's one of the larger arches in a park. It's really beautiful. It's one you can actually climb through the arch to the other side, and a lot of people do. And it's just a magnificent arch. And I'm looking at it and, you know, seeing how beautiful it is. And then I happened to think, you know, the arch is beautiful. Let me look at the surrounding rock just to see what that's like, you know, and get the whole picture, you know, the details. And I'm looking around to the left, and then I look to the right, and I suddenly saw in the rock a man's scowling face. I mean, at least to me it looked like that. You know, just the way the cracks in the rock and some of the little pebbles in the rock, it looked like there was, you know, a man's eye and his nose with nostrils, and then a sort of downturned mouth. And I went, wow, that really looks that way to me. And I asked lots of people, including the park rangers, had anybody ever mentioned that? And no one had.
And yet it looked that way to everyone?
And when I pointed it out to people, they went, oh, yeah, that is, you know, like a scowling man's face. And it's because everybody looked at the arch, but not at that one area of rock.
Fascinating. Fascinating. Yeah. I have a friend who does an observational exercise that he takes people through, and he has them walk a familiar territory of like a quarter of a mile. But he has them take, oh gosh, Neil, I can't recall, it's at least 30 minutes walking it and writing down things they have never noticed before.
Just before, right.
On this walk. And then maybe even taking a flower out of a sidewalk crack or something. And he says it's just shocking how many things people notice that they've never seen before when they're trying to pay attention.
Sure.
And I think that has to do with serendipity too, because serendipity really, every now and then it's a hammer, you know, that gets you. But a lot of times it's just a chisel. And
yeah, oh, absolutely. In fact, the majority of the historical pieces that I read were more the chisel than the hammer.
Tell me a chisel story of all the ones you read.
The best one, I think, and it's the best one because all four skills were necessary, was the how penicillin was discovered. And the story goes that Alexander Fleming was a physician and microbiologist in the United Kingdom. And he was experimenting with staphylococci. Those are bacteria that cause skin infections a lot. And you've heard staph infections, that's what we're talking about. What he was exploring was, he was putting them on those agar plates, you know, the petri dishes.
Yes.
But everybody grew them in a petri dish with the lid on. And he wanted to see if you have the lid off so that it was a natural air circulation, whether the growth would be different. Okay. But he had a sterile lab, and he plated the staphylococci, he took the lid off. He happened to go away for a long weekend. And somebody in the lab thought it was too stuffy, and so they opened a window. And some mold happened to blow in and got in onto the petri plates. He came back from vacation, saw that there was mold growing on his plates and started throwing them out, saying, you know, these are ruined. It's my, you know, my, it's not a big deal, but, you know, my week's worth of work is gone. And then he stopped because he looked closer and noticed that around the mold was a circle. And so he got curious as to, like, what's going on here? He looked at it under a microscope and found that the bacteria in the circle and at the edge around the mold were either dead or dying. And he put together that with his experience as a microbiologist and knew that the mold was secreting something onto the plate that was killing the bacteria. And so he began exploring it and found penicillin.
Secreting something onto the plate, not onto the bacteria. The bacteria came in contact with the chemicals on the plate.
That's right.
Amazing. Amazing. You know, the last of your four skills, making connections, I think this may be, for me, one of the most important questions, and that is, you use a term, and I like it, how can someone connect the dots? Let's say they have a serendipitous experience, and it just seems to be an outlier out there. How do we manage that process of recognizing such an occurrence and then taking advantage of it to a newly discovered opportunity?
There's one of a couple ways. Sometimes you may have, either experience or reading or training that allows you to connect those dots. Okay, I mean, that's how Fleming realized that it was something being secreted onto the plate, because he was a microbiologist. He knew that that meant there had to be something killing off those bacteria. And the only way it could happen is if the mold was secreting something onto the plate. But sometimes, going forward, if you get curious enough and start reading about it, you go, oh, that's what they're talking about. Now I know what I saw, you know, and can go from there.
I get it, yeah. You know, I'm kind of rehearsing my own life here, and I'm seeing from the age 30 on, it was more, when I made a decision, it was a very intentional decision, and I followed through, and it was well planned. But coming across making decisions were sort of indiscriminate. Something hit me that, you know, there was some serendipity, some bit of curiosity, some bit of something new that I said, I'd like to try that. And then as I tried it, more and more things encouraged me to go on. And so I've had a career as a minister, a manager of a large wet processing carpet mill. I've been a baseball coach. And the only reason I was a baseball coach is that I had a son. Now, all kids play baseball, but not all kids were as good as my son, which is proven that he's a professional baseball player today. And and that was what got me into baseball. And then I got into coaching, and it started off with coaching. And then somebody mentioned an idea about 360-degree feedback in 1995. And you know, I can just point to these occurrences that I never could have predicted. I never could have anticipated any of these things happening. And then my last venture, which is as a retired man, I donated to a charity, went on a trip to Africa, and the next thing I know, 4 years later, I'm vice president of operations and vice president of the board, and just spent 3 weeks in Africa. That was just these things sort of happening. You know, I didn't plan to be part of a charity. I didn't plan to be in a coach. I didn't plan to be an executive coach nor a baseball coach. That, for me, is the way my life has gone. Do you find that unusual, or do you think that's more the normal way, and perhaps people just have not recognized it?
from the people, you know, I'm certainly not a someone who investigates, you know, career paths and stuff. But from the people I have talked with, I think it's more common than people believe. I've seen it in lots and lots of people who have told me their life stories, especially since I've written the book. They headed one way, and then something intervened, you know, some serendipitous event, and it changed them on a different path. I mean, that's what happened with me. I knew I was going to be the doctor. I was going to be the small town doctor. And then in ninth grade, someone dared me to try out for the school play. And of course, the ninth grader never declines an opportunity over there. So I tried out. I got a small part. Absolutely fell in love with it. I was a terrible actor, but I fell in love with it. And I tried out for every single play thereafter and during high school. Always had a tiny part. Always loved it. And what it did is it enhanced my confidence in being in front of people and being on a stage. And then the second part of that was the last couple of weeks in high school as a senior, they had something called the Red Letter Day, where you put in your favorite, you know, put a list of your favorite teachers, and they matched you with one of your teachers. And for Red Letter Day, you were it. The teachers were not in the building. It was a couple of, you know, administrative people to make sure nothing got really out of hand. But you were the teacher for the day. I did that, and I went, oh, my God, I know I have to teach the rest of my life.
Really?
Yeah,
that, you know, see, I think that's, to me, Neil, that's the way life happens. We're in this big phase. I happen to be, because I had written a couple planning books, and so I get into those circles, and there is just this feeling of, you know, your annual plans and your annual goals. What are your five-year goals? And I just don't know. I just have a question mark. You know, my goals are value-centered. Of what difference I can make on the planet, how can I serve, but how you know who I can serve, but the exact parameters by which I will work or under which I will work are unclear. I just know I'm heading in this direction.
Yeah, I always look at that question about, you know, where do you plan to be in 5 years? Where do you plan to be in 10 years? And I laugh.
Two stories, and then we'll start wrapping it up, but. But one story is I was on an airplane. I can't remember the year. It had to be early 90s, and I was with a vice president of Charles Schwab. And they said they just had a meeting that they wanted to take trading of stock online. And no one it had not been done yet. And I asked him, so tell me about the meeting, because I was very curious. It sparked my curiosity. I said, tell me about the meeting. How did it go? And what was your conclusion of what you're going to do? And he says, well, we're not really sure what we're going to do, but we know one thing. We're headed west. He says, we're in New York. We don't know if we're going to land in St. Louis, L.A., or Seattle. But we know the one thing we do know is we're headed west. And I have always liked that. That has always been sort of a metaphor for my life. I'm headed west. I don't know where I'm going to land, but I do know a widespread direction, but not too narrowly defined until I get that information or that data or that serendipity that just gives me ultimate clarity, which I am, you know, not at liberty to speak of right now, but I'm in the middle of one right now that has turned out to be, you know, what I may spend the rest of my life doing. It's really fascinating.
Yeah.
As we wrap up our session here, I'm wondering if there's anything we haven't covered or something we've covered that's especially important to you that you would like our readers or listeners to take away from this conversation and from your book. What do you view as the takeaway?
I think the main takeaway is don't be afraid. Serendipity is happening all around. It usually ends up being a good thing. Even if not, you've learned something from it. the whole process is so awesome. It's so worth it. And all it takes is a little bit of initiative to learn the skills, how to recognize it, and know how to investigate it and get help if you need to do something with it. But it's so worth it that I hope people, you know, think about it and make the decision to try to start looking at it and dealing with it, basically.
Yeah, I'm going to put a link to your book on the show notes and recommend that people read it, because I think, as we're discussing, my conclusion from this discussion is that serendipity is more powerful than planning. Planning, you can force yourself out of your comfort zone and out of your skill set, and serendipity aligns with something deep in your inner core, something deeper than just your brain cells. There's you know, your cognitive brain cells. There's something else going on, and I think serendipity really covers that. And,
yeah,
and I applaud you.
It's definitely an emotional process when it happens.
Yeah, it's, you know, in our old left brain, right brain, it's a right brain activity.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Neil Farber, thank you so much for spending time with me today. And I love your stories. I love your concept. And as I said, I'll include a link to your book posted on the show notes. And I encourage everybody to take your four steps that I really like and keep an open mind. Practice observational skills, be curious, and work at making connections. Those are four brilliant tools. Thank you for that.
Well, you're welcome, and thank you for having me on.
My pleasure. And I also want to thank our listeners for tuning into The Next Chapter with Charlie. And please check out our website at thenextchapter.life, where you can, if you care to sign up, you get a podcast every Wednesday and a blog every Sunday. And until next, as always, this is Charlie Hedges signing off. Bye for now.